presence in commerce, although it was while I was still the ambassador that the switch was made where the commercial function was separated from state and put in the Department of Commerce.
Do you have any thoughts on that? Would that make a difference?
I don't understand why it was done, because I think it can be, from the commercial aspect, can be done just as adequately through the State Department, and there are political and other interconnections that make it much more sensible to have it all in the State Department. And why that was separation was agreed to, I don't understand.
I agree with you on that. Just another part of the weakening of the State Department.
Right.
Mel Searles now holds that position, you know. He worked for Esso in Hong Kong and then for a number of other private
firms. He holds this position where?
In Peking. He's now the commercial counselor, commerce fellow.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Directly for the Department of Commerce?
Commerce.
Oh, I didn't know that. I didn't know that had happened.
And they have a Department of Commerce person in Shanghai named Dan Tradiak. Do you know Dan Tradiak?
No, I knew Mel.
A little short guy from Hong Kong, kind of a hunchback midget. You remember that guy?
No, I never met him. Mel Searles, of course, I met many times. And he's a very competent, knowledgeable person.
Very good.
When the military came in, immediately after normalization, I was informed we had 33 in the total liaison office staff, and I got a message that the Department of Defense was ready to send us 36 immediately. Well, we negotiated that number down, but Bill Webb, who came in as the officer in charge, the defense attaché, Colonel Webb, who was made a brigadier general just before I left, and I was very pleased with that, because he and his colleagues couldn't have been better chosen to, and they made very wide contacts among the Chinese military. Very useful and beneficial context.
I bet they were less likely to complain about housing, too, were they? Or am I wrong?
Well, I never heard the complaints from them. No, they did really an extraordinary job. I see now they've all gone.
Right. One of them is working for General Dynamics, I think, in Tokyo.
He came in first as the chief.
Gilliland.
Colonel Gilliland from the...
Right.
Then he came in from the Army.
Right.
And Bill Webb came in representing the Air Force, and then when Gilliland... it was one of those catch-22 situations. He couldn't afford to stay on, because changes were made in the retirement regulations that it would have cost him money to have continued to serve in the Army. He made more money by retiring at that point. And he retired and almost immediately was offered this post in Tokyo. And it was at that point that Gilliland had been earlier stationed in Hong Kong. Bill Webb, who had already been there for the Air Force, became the chief of the military section. And he just left, I think, just a short time ago. I saw it somewhere. But all the representatives were excellent.
But you did not file evaluations of them either?
No.
And then station chief?
No.
Hmm.
I say no. I don't think so. I don't remember.
That's in a way is. Do you feel that is that system weakens an ambassador, or should the ambassador be involved in the evaluation of all of the people there as one way of establishing who the boss is?
Well, even as far as state personnel is concerned, it's made quite clear the ambassador can choose his deputy, even going outside the ranks if he wants to really insist, although that would take a bit of doing. He can, for cause, block a senior appointment, but it's made very clear that the system chooses chooses personnel. And you have to have more than I don't like so-and-so, or I'd prefer somebody else to get any change, without going into names of persons. There were a couple of occasions when the people involved just weren't working out right. Finally laid in my lap as the ambassador, and would I do something about it? Well, I had occasion then to get into the regulations and all the rest, and all these complaints. Where's the record? Well, there was no written record. All these complaints were taken up verbally with the individual, but no record, no memo made of the conversation or anything. And I said, until the record is made, until the case is made, there's just no way to sustain it. Now, that's much different than the old days when an ambassador's word was almost just not subject to contradiction or decision.
So, in effect, you are the manager of a slightly complex organization that has a life of its own.
Right. And that's why morale questions become that much more important. It's morale that determines the discipline of the group. It's not an it really can't be an imposed discipline anymore. No, it can be, but it's very cumbersome.
In a sense, this is a fascinating conversation, because we have focused heretofore on your role as a labor negotiator for being a diplomat. But I get the sense that your role as a manager of an organization, the UAW, which is sprawling, but central headquarters too, very common, may have been at least as important.
Oh, it was.
In preparing you for the position of ambassador. If you haven't had management experience, in other words, you shouldn't go off and become an ambassador, be your view.
It certainly helps a great deal. So the reason that I froze the staff number at 65, which I did post-normalization, although we not only could justify but had been allowed places going substantially beyond that, but we had so many in the hotel complaining about housing affecting their morale, and the size of the number being such that they in turn were infecting the total group, that we just made the decision to freeze the number. And strangely enough, that action in itself helped morale, because the notion had gotten around, Washington doesn't give a damn. The Chinese and the United States are getting away with murder. They're buying apartment buildings in New York City. They're not apartment buildings, the old Howard Johnson place, and state is letting them get away with it. And here in China, we're getting promises, but promises which aren't kept. And so my action was construed as being on their side sort of business. And it helped a great deal. And we did have the excitement of the events, of course, through 1979 helped tremendously. But we did have excellent morale for most of the time that I was there. But Sharon, in this respect, was also of tremendous help, because in the social events of the residence, we'd involve the families as much as possible, by the families, including the children, and to have special events at Easter time, so the kids could come, and we enjoyed it, yes, but it was also done to help the community morale. It paid off.
So you were quite conscious and deliberate in all of these decisions.
Oh, yes.
And did you talk about this with state, or was this basically your own, just your own sense that you knew how to do this?
As a matter of fact, in this particular state, was quite conservative. For example, at the biweekly staff meetings, I brought up the question that the wives should feel free to come. And they have no place there if they're not employees, was the rejoinder, which quite surprised me. Involvement in the social affairs, I'm not sure we discussed that. I did have the impression it was something he just didn't think about in that regard.
What you're saying now illuminates a point. When I arrived in China this summer, in fact, there was one New York Times article that was quite unfortunate before I got to China, I should stress, that morale after you left deteriorated.
Yes, I saw the story I saw was unfair.
Right, it was an unfair story,
right.
but what you're saying does go into that, that you sense a particular challenge.
Well, I noted in 1980, the period that we haven't yet come to, we were gone, Sharon and I were gone for 2 months, and going over the representation functions that were held from late May to late July, the time we were gone, there was no evidence of any involvement beyond
mm-hmm.
what was barely necessary. It was something obviously you didn't talk about. You didn't say, well, we're doing this, an end product we hope will be improved morale. And a lot of it came from Sharon, who has that kind of spirit.
Yeah.
And, of course, when we were first married, she still was the nurse, she knew all these small children anyway, as in her capacity as the nurse. And the children used to love to come to see our cat Peter, because the animals, pets are not that plentiful in Peking. And then Sharon also would have affairs that involved primarily the women at the
mm-hmm.
residence.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But we used to look upon the lower floor of the residence as sort of well, we refer to them as the public rooms, because, you know, you've been there, that
right.
There's Independence Hall over at the other, the old Romanian trade delegation location, but there's nothing else that comes close to those particular rooms on that lower floor of the residence to do the sort of thing that
so things
possible.
Like movies and all of that.
We didn't show movies there.
No.
Well, no, movies were better shown at Independence Hall because
right. But I mean,
so
this
was
also part of the effort. This thing, right? You wanted to keep an active program.
All the movies, we used to use the movies to show to our colleagues from the diplomatic community, because it was very frankly an easy way to keep in touch, much less fuss than a dinner, and you could invite a lot more people. So that and whenever we got a good American movie that the English-speaking ambassadors and their wives would enjoy, we utilized that for that purpose.
How often did you have movies?
After the military came, we got quite a lot
mm-hmm.
of late run movies.
Through the military. Did they get videotaped, too, of sports contests?
Yes. That came, a lot of those, I think, came through the CIA, because those we were getting earlier. Dave Grease used to get those.
Uh-huh.
We had strict instructions that if we showed them to Chinese, it had to be very limited. Because this was the problem the Motion Picture Producers Association having their feud with the Chinese wanting to buy the prints outright, and the Motion Picture Producers Association wanting to rent them on a per capita basis. They didn't care how much per capita, but the principle
right.
of per capita they had to preserve, not simply because of the great numbers in China, but because that's the way they do it around the world. They couldn't have sold prints to China without destroying their whole marketing system. But so whenever we did get late-run movies, we were under strict injunction to use them very circumspectly.
Did you ever invite Huang Hua for a late show, for a late movie?
See, what movie was, not Wang Hua, but we, Han Shu, Jiang Wenjin, their wives, Ji Jiaoju, what was the Vietnam movie?
Apocalypse Now.
Apocalypse Now, yes. We invited them to see that. Had quite a tussle about that because Sharon didn't want to see it because of her year in Vietnam. But she finally steeled herself. And it was rather curious to watch their political reaction. Their comments afterwards.
What were they?
I forget now, but I think there's some wonderment as to how we can be so critical of ourselves, of our own government, particularly with regard to a war. And no real understanding as to how that can be. And, or two others to which we invited them, and that I forget. But that didn't take place until quite late, because it was well into the end of 79, into 80, I would think, before willingness to accept purely social as distinct from a social but with some other end in view, like, you know, a reception that's given for a group just to come for a purely social thing was not acceptable until quite late in the game. Well, should we get back to the issue? In mid-January of 1980, Codell Wolfe, I guess this would have been the...
Coming in the heels of the Brown visit.
Oh, yes.
Codell Wolfe, you will remember Lester Wolfe. Let's set the stage for this. Lester Wolfe, distinguished chairman of the House Subcommittee on East Asian Affairs, or Asian Affairs, was off traveling, as he frequently did during the breaks, to the region. In this particular case, I think he was continuing to pursue in a vigorous fashion the narcotics problem, which meant that he left Washington before Secretary Brown did, and he therefore read in the paper about Secretary Brown's visit, including the decision to expand some of the realms of technology that we were prepared to sell China. We've not yet made public our decision on sale of non-lethal military equipment. So he felt that his dignity as a congressman had been affronted. Not only had we done this a normalization, but in spite of all of his upbraiding of us, we had learned no lesson. And he was arriving in China.
Yes, and he was very unhappy with me because of that. It was conveyed to me that when I had seen him back in the United States in December, that I had lied to him.
Thought we all had.
But I think during my conversations with him, we got that cleared up. And of course, as I think I recorded before, I did not go with Secretary Brown on the rest of his visit in China, because we still had pending with the Chinese the question of what they would do with regard to the hostage problem in Iran when the second vote was to come in the Security Council of the UN on the question of implementation. They had voted with us to impose sanctions. They had voted with us on a resolution which set a deadline for the release of the hostages, or sanctions would be imposed. It was an affirmatively worded resolution, but then the question of how to implement it needed a second resolution. And this was the matter that had been taken up very urgently by Secretary Brown with the Chinese, and they still had not given us an answer, and so I stayed behind. I think it's lucky also that I was in Peking when Codell Wolfe arrived, so that I could talk directly to Lester Wolfe, who was a very conscientious chairman, always did his work. It's too bad that what caused his defeat in 1980 was the charge that he was always traveling around the world, which was true, but they were not junkets.
That's right.
Extremely hard working, and in a part of the the world extremely important to the United States. He arrived on Wednesday, January the 16th. I was at the airport to greet him. Nothing was said then. Went to the welcoming banquet that night. I was unaware of any feelings, but then on the morning of Thursday morning, we had the group out for breakfast for a briefing, and it came out then. Not just he and I one-on-one, but in the whole group. The following day, Friday, another breakfast. This one was hosted by Vice Foreign Minister Jiang Wen-jin for the CODEL. By this time, Lester Wolf is not satisfied with what has happened, but he is satisfied, I think, that I knew no more about what was going to happen than he did. But at this breakfast, hosted by Jiang Wen-jin, the question of the intentions of North Korea came up, as it did so frequently. And the Chinese gave their the answer they'd been giving for some time: do not worry, there will be no attack by North Korea. I remember Lester Wolf said, "How do you know there won't be an attack by North Korea?" And this was the occasion when Jiang Wen-jin said, "Because the Koreans know we have enough trouble with our own, with our other borders, not to be able to come to help them this time." In my hearing, at least, no Chinese was ever so forthright subsequent times when this was discussed. Now, it had been the day before that Jiang Wen-jin called me in to give the final answer with regard to the hostages. I may have said this before, but in case I didn't, to say that they were still in complete support our position. It was an absolutely unacceptable breach of international law, but they could not vote for the imposition of sanctions. They were worried about the impact it would have on the Iranian government, push them into the arms of the Soviet Union. They would not vote against it. In fact, they would not even come to the meeting. They would not abstain. They just would not attend the meeting, so that they would not obstruct any action we could otherwise get. CODEL Wolf had their vice premier's meeting, not with Deng Xiaoping, but with Ji Pengfei. Then I see we gave a reception in honor of the CODEL, so I must have been working to improve relations with the CODEL. Then Frank Press came back for further meetings with Fong Yi.
First consultation of his
right.
committee.
There was a plenary session on the morning of January 22nd, and a dinner hosted that night. And then we had a big reception for them at the residence on the Wednesday night. 120 people. This delegation met with Deng Xiaoping and signed 5 protocols and a general memorandum. And the Dr. Press had a press conference at the Bruce Building and left on the
2-day trip, if I recall.
22nd, 23rd, and 24th of January, right.
I think Roger came. That trip. I'm not certain. I'm pretty sure that that was Roger Sullivan's first trip as my successor on the NSC staff. I think he did not come with Brown, but went on that one.
Yes. Yeah, I think so, right. Yes, he did.
And I backstopped for him on the NSC, and then I left.
And then late in January, I had a meeting with Foreign Minister Wang Hua. The question of the Olympics boycott. And of course, they were immediately and solemnly with us on that question. The other item I have under this is the Pakistan visit. It would have been...
Wang Hua went to Pakistan, didn't he?
Yes. But why would I be raising that with him?
For what their level of supplies to Pakistan were going to be, and to encourage him...
Afghanistan.
Yes, and to encourage him to indicate to the PACs that our level of support was realistic instead of to deride
that
it.
That was it.
We didn't want them to go off and start saying, what are your American friends like? Look how much they give. We wanted them to be supportive of us. You couldn't count on it.
General Zia-ul-Haq had used very derisive language in characterizing our offer. That
package.
Was it. Right. Then during this period...
We also, I might say, another thing we were interested in doing is ascertaining exactly what the Chinese were going to be doing for the PACs and what level of supplies they were going to be giving themselves.
That question was raised. The answer that I got was that we'll do what we can. We are a very poor nation.
Yeah, but we were interested in some specific weapon systems, if you may recall. Did you handle that, or was that done in Washington?
I think it was also done in Washington because we didn't get very far in Peking.
Well, we detailed on the Washington side the weapon systems that we would be providing the PACs, which we thought might possibly eventually end up in Afghan hands, and we indicated what we were arranging. I guess that this was done in Washington. We indicated what we were arranging through the Egyptians which the Saudis were financing, and then outline where we thought the Chinese might play a helpful role.
In this period, we began what were really protracted and long drawn out negotiations for a consular agreement. Our difficulty there was we wanted to break new ground as compared to the consular agreements that China had with other Western nations on the question of the consular districts.
Right.
And that was a very troublesome question. I was told by informally by a high official of the foreign ministry, Chinese, that we didn't seem to understand that communications were relatively poor in China, and to give our consulates substantially sized districts, we would begin to fashion precedents made with local officials that would be contrary to the policy actually pursued by the Peking government, and that it was very difficult to have a nationally determined policy that quite frequently local officials just took the bit in their teeth. And this was in the early part of 1980. This was conveyed to me.
What I don't quite follow. One of the key issues was the jurisdiction of the Shanghai consulate, as I remember,
Shanghai
and whether it was
Canton
to include Anhui province specifically.
Their position started out by being just the city, just
right.
Shanghai city and Guangzhou. They then included the Shanghai area and Guangdong, the province. But we wanted more than that. And it was in that connection that...
But what were they afraid of? That's what I'm not clear. Were they afraid that we would be encouraging Zhejiang province to deal directly with us instead of through Peking?
No, but the inevitable dealings we would have with local officials, whether provincial officials, that precedents would be established by those provincial officials with us that would be troublesome because they would very possibly not be consistent with the policy of the Peking government.
Oh, I see. So that we were becoming a force for disunity.
Yes.
That's a very important issue.
For the admission, disunity was there. And we would not be fostering it necessarily, nor taking advantage of it. But the lack of communication, was on communication. The lack of effective communication
We inadvertently could exacerbate centrifugal forces within China. Is that
yes.
the point?
Yes, right. Now, that was never said formally, never said in the actual negotiating sessions. And this was said to be an informal atmosphere at a reception.
Can you say who said that to you?
Jiang Wenjin.
He did. That's fascinating.
And, of course, when they did finally agree to the larger districts. I would think at that particular time there was considerable uncertainty as to how effective the effort at reform was going to be in, as far as the provinces were concerned. Because it took a great deal of time to finally negotiate the consular agreement. Months went by before it was finally accomplished.
That would mean a decision of that sort would be made at the Politburo level.
Oh, I'm sure, yes. Chiefs of Missions Conference in 1980 in Singapore, which is certainly a delightful place to go.
Was Harry Thayer there already?
No.
He was still the former governor of South Dakota.
South Dakota. Yes.
Turned out not to be one of the more intellectually astute ambassadors
that
we have brought, as I've heard him described.
It was shortly before that that his former deputy had had written the article which really held him up to be an absolute idiot. It was certainly overdrawn. And the location had already been chosen before that article appeared. Otherwise, I doubt if we would have gone. And we had two special sessions during that Chiefs of Missions Conference on the whole problem of Indochina. What we should do with regard to Cambodia, Vietnamese presence. With Dick Holbrooke pushing very hard for, I think, to elicit an approach that would have made possible a different kind of relationship with Vietnam than otherwise developed. The meetings were inconclusive. I remember Mike Mansfield sat silently through the first one, and was sitting silently through the second one when Dick asked him a question directly, and he almost exploded. Haven't we learned not to go fishing in this part of the world to make trouble? We don't have that much power, we can't do it. And it was on that note that
Dick gave up.
Yeah, just called off the meetings.
Dick was just trying that time after time. It's exactly one of the arguments that Roger and I used on him. Where is one's diplomatic grasp must be backed by an adequate amount of resources to make it convincing.
Knipe was the ambassador's name, Richard
right.
Knipe.
Right.
And a small group of us, Dick Holbrooke, Admiral Long, who was SINCPAC commander, and Mike Mansfield, myself, and Dick Knipe went late one evening to have a meeting with Prime Minister Lee Kuan Yew and his Deputy Prime Minister Goh Kang Sui.